Hello and welcome to the first episode of Haaretz Weekend, a glossy audio supplement on Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spangin and on today's show... We've got a packed show for you today, listener, so I'm going to dispense with the verbose preamble and simply introduce today's panel. Judy Maltz is back with us, and we're going to be talking about the impact the new government, tfu-tfu-tfu, will have on matters of state and religion. How are you, Judy?
I'm doing well. How are you, Simon?
Good, thank you. We've also got a couple of blasts from the past here. Science and archaeology editor Ruthie Schuster and archaeology correspondent Ariel David will be talking about ancient atrocities, Judean eating habits, and the very first World War. Good to have you here, guys.
Thank you very much. We're delighted to be here.
Hi, Simon. Good to see you.
We're also joined by a man who's seen it all. Haaretz's TV and movie reviewer, Adrian Hennigan, who will be telling us about a new biopic of Menachem Begin and what it was like being back in a movie theater after so many months. Hi, Adrian. How's it going?
Hi, Simon. All good, thanks.
Good, good. So before we start, I ought to address the elephant in the room. How can we be doing a weekend edition in a country that doesn't actually have a weekend? Famously, Friday is a half day here in Israel, and on Sundays we're all back to work. So for the purposes of this podcast, we're just going to have to pretend that there is such a thing as an Israeli weekend. Are we all on board with that?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll put on our pretending hats for the next few minutes. Judy, speaking of weekends, what are the chances that the so-called government of change, which is due to be sworn in on Sunday, will introduce changes that might allow Israelis to enjoy their one day of rest? Are we finally going to get public transportation on the Holy Sabbath?
Well, I'd say there are probably going to be a few little positive changes for those who are in favor of freedom of religion and Jewish pluralism, but don't expect any major earthquakes with this new government. If you looked at the guidelines that were published about their position on religion and state affairs, they write here the following. The status quo, the religious status quo, will be maintained except in issues where it will be decided to introduce change. Okay? So, I mean, what does that say to you, Simon?
That says that they haven't decided that anything could happen.
Right, right. So you were asking about Shabbat, for example, right? Public transportation on Shabbat. Now, we know that public transportation on Shabbat started already a year and a half ago. I can't remember. It was before COVID, right? So it was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, but it was started at the initiative of cities. This was municipal government. It was not a national thing. And cities just started operating buses of their own. So I think we can probably say that given that the transportation ministry will be headed by Meirav Michaeli, who is the head of the Labor Party, and the Labor Party is a party that advocates for more religious freedom. It is not a religious party. So it would be probably safe to assume that she will be helpful in allowing those cities that want to move ahead with this to do so and not stand in their way, as was the case with the previous government pre-COVID, because I don't think there's been a lot of progress since then. So that's one thing. What else? I think one of the things that will probably be of interest to our readers abroad, not so much Israelis, is the Kotel, the Western Wall, and prayer at the Western Wall.
Mm, how many decades have we been hearing about that compromise?
God, I can't even remember.
Probably as long as the wall has been standing, right?
Right. But you remember there was this agreement that was supposed to have allowed the non-Orthodox movements, Reform and Conservative, to have their own prayer space at the wall. They actually do have a prayer space, but it was supposed to be much bigger and more beautiful and kind of equal to the prayer space that now exists for Orthodox prayer, which is segregated. And it had been passed by the Netanyahu government. But then suddenly the ultra-Orthodox parties woke up one day and discovered, what, we passed that? No way, over our dead bodies. We're not going to be in this government if you go through with that. So in the end, he said, that's it. We are suspending this agreement. Considering that there are no ultra-Orthodox parties in this new government, and considering that the new prime minister, the first of the two, is Naftali Bennett, who actually was quite an advocate of this Kotel deal, it's a no-brainer, I think. They're gonna do it. For most Israelis, it could hardly make a difference because they don't really go to the Kotel. But for our American friends and readers, this is probably going to be the biggest news and the biggest story on changes that deal with religion and state.
Mm. So Rick Jacobs, the head of the reform movement, he sounded quite optimistic in his interview with Alison Kaplan-Summer over what the Bennett-Lapid government will mean for Israel-diaspora relations, right?
Well, yeah, I agree with him that there will definitely be a different tone now with this new government. This is a government, how did someone joke, the most religious member of the government is probably Mansour Abbas, who's from the Islamic Party. You know, even Bennett's party, which is officially an Orthodox party, he's got a few members there, such as Ayelet Shaked, who are completely secular. And he himself is not the most religious guy. So you have a government that will be much friendlier to the non-Orthodox movements, much more open to them. They're not going to be telling them constantly, we don't need you. Our real buddies are the evangelicals. And there are many more of them than there are of you, and who needs you guys? Now, this is going to be, they'll be much friendlier. You know, one of the things in the coalition agreement, it's not clear whether it's going to happen or not, is the Diaspora Affairs Ministry, which is supposed to be in charge of Israel's relations with the diaspora, is going to set up a new division for Jewish renewal. And I think that's a code word for promoting non-Orthodox streams of Judaism. Mm. And we should mention the fact that under the agreement, the new Diaspora Affairs Minister will be a member of the Labor Party. It's supposed to be Nachman Shai. I don't know if that's official yet. But anyway, so that's really quite a departure from the past when the ministers of that ministry that was supposed to be in charge of relations with the Jewish world was always Orthodox. So I understand why he's encouraged.
So that might be good news for non-Orthodox strains of Judaism. But I think the evangelicals may never forgive the government of change for ousting Netanyahu, right? And certainly not Mike Evans. Do the evangelicals only love Israel because of Bibi? Are they going to desert us if he's no longer prime minister?
Not according to what they've been saying. I mean, Mike Evans, it seems like he's going to desert us if his friend Bibi is not prime minister. But I haven't yet heard one evangelical leader come out and back him up on this. What they're all saying now, and they're extremely troubled by his remarks because they've invested so much in the past few decades in trying to build relations with Israel and trying to reassure Israelis that they have no ulterior motives and they're not out to convert them and this is not about Armageddon and the Second Coming and they really just love us because of who we are and unconditionally and all that. And then along comes somebody like Mike Evans and says, no way, if it's not Bibi, you know, you can say goodbye to all of us and all our money and all our help and, you know. So nobody is siding with him. And in fact, if you saw, we published a piece yesterday that included this very interesting survey that shows that in fact, contrary to popular opinion, the evangelicals aren't maybe as right-wing as we tend to think when it comes to Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And in fact, quite a large share of them seem open to the idea of Israel giving back part of the biblical heartland, establishing a Palestinian state there. So they're not all, and probably the majority, are not like Mike Evans.
Well, let's hope not, for sure.
Yeah.
Ariel, all of this talk of religion and state put me in mind of a piece you wrote a couple of weeks ago, which suggests that certain religious observances have changed over time, and that ancient Judeans commonly ate non-kosher seafood. Not quite surf and turf, right? No?
Almost.
Is it possible that kashrut, one of the signposts of Judaism, as you put it, is actually fluid?
Yeah, it certainly seems so. I mean, this specific study looked at the presence of fish bones, and specifically of non-kosher fish bones in the archaeological record through about 2,000 years of history. Mm. And the researchers behind that said, well, you know, let's see when the Judeans, the inhabitants of ancient Israel, started keeping kosher. And what the archaeologists found is that pretty much until the late Second Temple period, almost until Roman times, you find evidence in the archaeological record that people in Jerusalem and in Judea were eating scaleless and finless fish. And the Bible explicitly prohibits these fish. In this case, they found bones of catfish and sharks and even stingrays and eels. And obviously, these are not kosher according to the Bible. Mm. But it seems like, at least during the First Temple period, and even well into the Second Temple period, the Judeans either didn't know about this prohibition. Maybe the Bible already existed then. That's a whole other can of worms. When was the Bible written? Mm. But maybe it was written, maybe it wasn't written. But people did not know or did not observe this particular prohibition and did not essentially keep, doesn't seem like they kept kosher at the time.
Mm. Was it widespread? Was everybody eating these non-kosher food? Or was it just a case of you know, some good Jews, some bad Jews, as there is today?
If I could interject here, we don't know who was doing the eating. Mm. In other words, at this point, we can say that this is where they were found. And the interpretation is that it was the Jews of the time who were eating. But that can't be proved.
It could be non-Jewish residents of Judea?
Theoretically, it could have been non-Jewish residents, or it could have been very laxly observant residents. Mm. Right now, however, based on the sheer prevalence of this, because there were quite a lot of them, the thinking is that it was the Judeans after all, and that the exact laws of kashrut had either not taken force here or were not known here or were simply ignored, much as they are today in many of the restaurants of Tel Aviv.
I think the scholars addressed this in their study, and they said, you know, we looked at 21,000 fish bones from 30 archaeological sites, many in Jerusalem and in Israel, throughout Israel, spanning 2,000 years. And, you know, it would be special pleading, I think that's what they said, to say that, these were just some foreigners visiting and they were eating non-kosher food. Mm. The fact remains that, yeah, it's true. We don't know exactly what it means if there was a law, a rule, and they just weren't observing it, or they just didn't know about this rule. We don't know what it means. But it does seem from the archaeological evidence that kashrut was not observed until much later. And what's interesting, it's not just kashrut, because over the last years, archaeologists have been looking at other signposts of Judaism and asking, well, when did this all start? So they've been looking, for example, at mikvaot, which are ritual baths. Yeah. And also these appear only in the late part of the Second Temple period. They've been looking at the Second Commandment, okay? Thou shalt not make graven images. Well, in the First Temple period and the Second Temple period, especially in the Persian era, there's figurines, there's images, on coins from Judea. So the Second Commandment seems to be also something that was respected only very late, only late in the Second Temple period, do images and figurative art completely disappear. And so on and so forth. They've been doing this with other mezuzot, tefillin, which only appear again in the late Second Temple period, and so on and so forth.
Mm. I just wanted to add a modern twist to this story, because it's very interesting. I grew up in the religious world, and I know a lot of religious people who eventually became non-religious. And for many of them, it's very, very difficult to eat pork. That is taboo. They just can't bring themselves. Mm. But I find it funny that many of them have no problem with seafood. It's the pork, and I've always wondered why is that the case, and I thought it might be because many of them had grandparents or great-grandparents who came from Europe where you just didn't eat seafood. It wasn't a thing, and, you know, the taboo was pork and ham, and that's what the Gentiles ate, and we don't eat this. So who knows?
My beloved mother-in-law, Susan Lowy, once said something fascinating to me. They are non-observant Jews living in Britain who do attend temple on the weekends, by the way, and they ate freely of non-kosher fare. However, she said to me, they would never eat pork. They would very happily eat shrimp. Why? She said it very simply. Jews died rather than eat pork. And she said, not a Jew laid down his life for a shrimp.
That's true.
But can I shatter, I'm sorry to be the spoiler.
Please.
Can I shatter this? I mean, and this is absolutely true of Jews today, that eating pork is a signpost of Judaism. It's perhaps the signpost. Right. But apparently, it doesn't seem like this was the case even in the First Temple period. Because initially, back in the 1990s, archaeologists were digging in the land, and they saw, okay, they did find an absence of pork bones in First Temple period layers, okay? And then they went to the Philistine cities, and they saw that there was quite a bit of pork there. So they said, aha, this is exactly what you were saying, Julian, right? So this is a sign that Jews were here and Israelites were here, and they were already respecting kosher. But then in the last years, what they found is that actually the entire Levant didn't actually eat so much pork. Because even in the Bronze Age, before the Torah was written, before the Israelite kingdoms arose, you also don't find a lot of pig bones. You almost find no pig bones at all. And so what the Canaanites were respecting the Torah. And so what the archaeologists think today is that actually we cannot look at the archaeology of pork and the absence of pork as an ethnic religious marker. Because it seems like this was simply part of the economy and the environment that people simply didn't grow pork. And there was no pork husbandry, and it was just not part of the local diet, except for the Philistines, who we know had some Aegean influences, and so they probably imported pigs from abroad. But everyone else, the Canaanites, the Arameans, the Phoenicians, and of course the Israelites too, They just weren't that interested in pork. It just wasn't part of their diet. Mm-hmm. And the biblical prohibition probably only came later, on top of this already existing sort of dietary habit, which was sort of regional.
Mm-hmm. It bears adding that our local pigs are very smart boars. And indeed, the Philistines did bring pigs over on their ships. It has been discovered, thanks to pigs on wrecks. So yes, the Philistines absolutely imported their own domesticated version of a pig, and our boars were left unmolested.
Listener, you won't have seen this, but during that little last exchange, Ruthie was warning Ariel not to break embargo on something. And is it okay if I share with our listeners the embargo problem that we have in general? A lot of the big revelations that you guys write about can only be published at a very specific time on a very specific day. And I've always been slightly amused by the idea of breaking news from the late Upper Paleolithic era. But I guess if we've waited 50,000 years for something, we can wait a few more days, right?
And now you remind me of my ex-husband, Martin, who said to me, why do you have Google alerts for dinosaurs? They have been dead for 60 million years. What is the urgency?
On the flip side, you do get to break stories, pun intended, about archaeologists finding and smashing a 1,000-year-old egg, right? A great story, Ruth, even if it sounds like a bad yolk.
Well, I'm delighted that you were so happy about that. I happened to notice that they reported finding the egg whole, and then the egg was no longer whole. Something happened, and they were going to analyze what remained of its yolk, and I said, what happened to that egg? And so they told me, and I was intrigued to discover that indeed it is incredibly rare to find a whole. It was a chicken egg, mark you. Chicken eggs have tiny little thin shells. It's not like an ostrich egg, which has a fairly massive shell. And those tend to weather time a little better. Chicken eggs are delicate, plus people eat them. And yet there it was. It had spent 1,000 years in a toilet. We do not ask how it got there. And being encased by, as she put it, soft waste, thank you. It was saved all these years. And I asked her, by the way, while we were about this, what is it like to excavate a 1,000-year toilet? And to everybody's relief, she said, it's like digging in dirt. It has become dirt. And then the egg did what eggs do. It's very sad.
It broke. Well, you can't make a headline without breaking a few ancient eggs, right? So, you know, I kind of wanted to steer the conversation away from war in these weekend editions, or at least contemporary war, I guess. Ruthie, Ariel, you've both written absolutely fascinating pieces recently about new war-related discoveries.
I'd like to open this with a story that I ran actually a couple of years ago, to which I added a caveat a couple of weeks back. It's about what is believed to be the oldest race war in the world. The remains were discovered in Sudan, and they date to about 13,000 years ago.
Wow.
Why did they think it was a race war? Because the archaeologists, this is a couple of years back, realized that we are dealing with two groups of people who looked very different. They were morphologically different. One race, or one group, was taller, and they had longer torsos and shorter legs, and vice versa. So in other words, they reached the conclusion that these people had been fighting different groups over resources. But the true horror of the situation became clear with more recent research, which shed more light on two things. First of all, they were not just, this wasn't one war. It wasn't just in and out, you know, fight each other for a few weeks, bash each other over the heads with rocks and leave. No, this was going on over decades. And how do we know that? Because we find skeletons with healed injuries. In other words, these were people who were fighting, getting badly wounded, healing, and then fighting again until they died. Okay? Another point is that these skeletons were not just men. They were men, women, and children. So, but because of the healed wounds, they reached the conclusion that these were wars that had lasted over a very long time. But the true horror is the nature of weapons that the archaeologists began to realize they had been using. These were not simple spears or even arrows, which had been invented several tens of thousands of years earlier, indeed. They seem to have made a kind of flower shape at the end of their spear with lots of blades. Okay? So they weren't stabbing each other with one blade. They were stabbing each other with a flower made of blades to cause maximum bleeding and pain, which is absolutely horrifying. And they reached that conclusion based on the marks that they found on the bones. And here I would just like to add one caveat, which is that in archaeology, so many things depend on interpretation. Okay? None of the things that I have just said are categorical facts. Mm-hmm. Calling it a race war is an interpretation of finding two separate, two very distinct morphologies. The nature of the wounds leads to speculation, leads to hypotheses, which can be more or less plausible about the nature of the weapons that created these wounds. I became convinced reading the paper that this was very plausible, which is why I wrote the story up. But it just lends thought to the horrors that we see in modern warfare and between civilizations today, and the fact that maybe we just have not changed as much as we like to think.
And indeed, I mean, war memorials, Ariel, go back 4,000 years at least, right?
Apparently, archaeologists have reinterpreted their findings about this mysterious monument, this mysterious mound, which was found in Syria. They excavated this this mound about 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, at Tel Banat, which is an ancient settlement from Mesopotamian times. It was occupied already 5,000 years ago. And I say they excavated this this monument 20 years ago because essentially it's no longer there. And this is an interesting part of the story and is also connected to war, because first, this excavation at Tel Banat was done because this ancient settlement was going to be flooded, and it was indeed flooded by the construction of the Tishrin Dam on the Euphrates River. Tel Banat is on the eastern side of the Euphrates. Now it's under the Euphrates. And so part of it was flooded back in 1999 when the dam was completed. And then what was left above water has been severely damaged when ISIS took over the area at the beginning of the Syrian civil war. So war influence comes back to the same place continuously. And but what is interesting about this this mound, which is an artificial mound, but it's about 7 stories high and 100 meters in diameter, is that archaeologists found there dozens of human remains. And what, again, as Ruth was saying, this is an interpretation. But what they interpret this as being is a war memorial to dead in some long-forgotten war. Why is this a war memorial? Because the bodies, the remains they found were, first of all male, at least those who could be identified, were all male. Mm. And they were buried, apparently, according to their unit, their military unit, mm. with their equipment. So there was a group of soldiers, and it's interesting to note that many of these were very young soldiers, possibly even 8 or 10 years old. Well, the archaeologist said there are child soldiers today, so we shouldn't be surprised that there were child soldiers 4,400 years ago.
Yeah.
And they were buried, apparently, according to the unit. So one unit was buried with these biconical pellets, which were common ammunition for slingshots. Okay, so this was kind of like an infantry troop. And then there was another group of remains that were buried in teams. Okay, so you had an adult male and a teenager, usually buried together with the remains of an equid, probably an onager or a donkey, a wild donkey. And what they, again, interpretation, what the archaeologists interpret this to be, is to be chariot teams. Okay, so these were chariot teams, an older adult who was the driver of the chariot, a younger soldier who was his assistant, and of course the animals who were pulling the chariots. They were donkeys because at the time the horses hadn't been introduced yet from Central Asia, where they were only introduced in the second millennium BCE, and here we're talking about something that was happening in 2400 BC.
What, does this shed new light on any other sites that we might not yet have fully understood the significance of?
Well, what's interesting is that this is a very strange and unique site, and it's a pity that it's underwater actually now. But what we do know, we do have in Mesopotamian texts and depictions, we have this idea that Mesopotamian kings, when they won a battle, they would pile up the bodies of the deceased, you know, and in a pyre, and then but this was done to humiliate the defeated. And what we see here is that these bones of these soldiers were sort of lovingly taken and buried in this sort of very ritualistic way, according to their units, with honor and with their equipment. And so this is kind of a unique site for that period, and it seems like it was either an attempt by the community to honor its dead, or perhaps an attempt by whoever was behind this war, behind this victory. We don't know who it was, but an attempt to sort of project power. You know, they built this huge monument, which
that presumably could be seen for miles.
It was. It was on. Yeah. It was on the plain of the, you know, the Euphrates, and it stuck up like a Thor thumb. It's called the White Monument because it was covered in gypsum, so it gave it a white sheen. So it could be seen from miles away, and it's certainly something that, you know, projects power. And so beyond maybe the idea that this was done to honor the dead, there is the possibility, again, interpretation, that this was also done to project power and to say, well, you know, this is our territory. We whoever it is, but this is our territory. We paid with our blood for it, and it now belongs to us.
And our dead ancestors are looking after the land.
Think of war memorials today. They in a way, they have the same function as well.
I mean, the other article that I wanted to ask you about, Ariel, is The Philistine's Last Stand, talking about the fall of Gath, Goliath's hometown, almost 3,000 years ago. I apologize in advance for this pun. Have they made a giant discovery there?
Oh, dear.
I know. I'll get it out my system the next episode, punless.
Okay. Anyway, no, I mean, it's fascinating because what they discovered, it's a very small discovery, and it's fascinating how very tiny items can really tell a story in archaeology, in history in general. And what they found there is it's 2,800-year-old arrowhead, and it's made of bone. Okay. Now, if this was a prehistoric dig and not, you know, a major Philistine city from the Iron Age, if this was a prehistoric dig, it wouldn't be that unusual to find an arrowhead made of bone. But by the Iron Age, as the term suggests, most weapons and certainly arrowheads would have been made with metal. And so what archaeologists interpret this as being is an arrowhead that is connected to the last days of Gath. Okay, so people know the Gath from the Bible as being the home of the giant Goliath, as you mentioned. But what happened to Gath? Well, according to the Bible and also according to the archaeological evidence, it was destroyed by the Aramean king Hazael around 830 BCE. He invaded the Kingdom of Israel. He invaded the Philistine lands, and he besieged up against Gath and destroyed it. And so what the archaeologists think is this is a sort of a dramatic piece of evidence from the last days of Gath. When the people of Gath were besieged, they didn't have raw materials to make metal arrowheads. Mm. So they used bones, animal bones, to make arrowheads to defend themselves. And they even found a workshop where they found sort of remains of cattle bones, these long bones from the legs, the metapodials, which are particularly, they're long, so they're particularly good to produce arrowheads. So they even found the workshop where they think that these bone arrowheads may have been produced.
Mm. It bears adding in this context that obviously the best would have been a metal arrowhead, as we all know and love. A second to that, of course, would have been stone, but that is really difficult to make. Now, as metallurgy developed in the Middle East and Near East, they were in parallel using stone technology. In other words, it's not that everybody was overnight said, oh, wow, metal knife. They didn't have them. However, by this time they did. Mm. They definitely had metal arrowheads. If they had had time, they could have made stone instead of the metal. But this is part of the reason why they suspect that this extraordinary bone arrowhead is such a sign of incredible desperation, because it's almost as if they had nothing else that they could make arrows with. Mm. However, the question is how useful it might have been. There was another weird point here, Ariel, about where it was found. In other words, if we're saying that this was the last stand of the Philistines and they were making a bone arrowhead because they were so desperate and they were out of material and they needed to make something quickly that they could fire, and it showed signs that it had been fired and used, yet we found it inside Gath. Over to you, Ariel.
It was found within the walls of Gath. And the explanation for that is, well, okay, so you would say, because that makes sense, that would mean that the Arameans fired that weapon, you know, from outside. They made it and they fired it. But the interpretation that the archaeologists give to that is that the Arameans were a very powerful army. They, at the time, they conquered basically half of the Middle East, and they wouldn't have resorted to this kind of sort of inferior technology. But what was common at the time was reusing projectiles. So it's quite possible that the Gittites made this arrow, fired it at the at their enemies, and then the Arameans just picked it up and fired it back.
And then we found it.
And then we found it.
So, Adrian, we've been saving the best for last. Well, certainly the least gory. Before we get on to Jonathan Gruber's documentary about Menachem Begin, how was it going back to the cinema? From what I understand, you were about to finish Netflix, so they reopened just in time.
I went back yesterday for the first time since 2020. On the one hand, I couldn't quite believe I was sitting in the cinema again. And like, and before all the horrible adverts started, there are literally people taking pictures of their giant tub of popcorn and like celebrating the return of man and like humankind at its finest. And it was, I mean, it was amazing because the cinema was full. I went to see Tenet with my daughter and I'd seen it already. And I thought, I really need to see this on the big screen to see if it makes any more sense. Didn't for me, but it was just so lovely to be in an atmosphere with, I mean, hopefully a clean atmosphere. I mean, they give you so much bump before the film starts about how safe it is in there, that they've got the best air conditioning in the world that's actually going to prolong your life, never mind save you from COVID. And then the film starts and it's like, and you know, you can just, I didn't even mind all the people sort of coughing behind me. It was just a joy.
A maskless experience, I take it.
Not for me, actually. Because as soon as I heard the first cough behind me, I thought, you know what, I'll be safe for a while. But I think it was just me wearing a mask.
So let's talk then about Upheaval, the journey of Menachem Begin. In fact, let's hear an excerpt.
His whole vision for Israel was for Jews to come here, feel like it's a safe haven.
באיזה סגנון אתה מתכוון להיות ראש ממשלה?
סגנון יהודי טוב.
What he want to say is stay straight.
שנשו מותניכם, חזקו רוחכם.
Very different from my political views, but I think he was one of the greatest leaders that Israel had.
Menachem Begin believed in the need for the Jews to seize their future.
Begin was very much a survivor.
Never again there won't be another Holocaust in the history of the Jewish people.
He was described as being anti-democratic, but he proved to be the most democratic of all.
He had faith in his convictions and a very clear view of the way that things are supposed to go.
He was a hero for all the Jewish Ethiopian community.
No more war.
He had the credibility to make the first peace with an Arab nation.
He was a man of profound contradictions.
Both sides were engaged in an existential fight.
Israel has nothing to apologize for.
Menachem Begin, with all his faults, belonged to a different class of leader.
Rise, struggle, and guarantee the prospect of living in peace for your children and their children.
So, Adrian, you spoke to Jonathan Gruber, the American director of Upheaval, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Of all the Israeli icons, what drew him to Begin?
I think the fact that with a lot of Israeli history, people just don't know this guy now. Mm. Yeah, I think it's almost like we forget there was a life before Bibi came along and, you know, changed politics in Israel. And here is this guy who was the first right-wing leader and is revered by so many right-wingers. I mean, you could argue that his timing couldn't have been worse. I mean, short of releasing an Idi Amin cookbook, I couldn't think of anything that might play worse in America at the minute than something that is very reverential to this right-wing guy who did so much that, you know, still affects Israel today with the settlements, you know, with the courting of the evangelicals. And I mean, the documentary doesn't go into that because even the critics there are very much coming from the right, but it's a fascinating portrait of this man who was a mensch in many ways, you know, this guy who survived the Holocaust. Yeah, this was a politician who was very much connected to the Holocaust, and everything he did, you know, was reflected through the Holocaust. I think what's really telling in the documentary is his love for his wife, Eliza. And just, it's unimaginable almost. I mean, I say it's unimaginable. I was reminded of Joe Biden at times because at the most crucial, biggest moments in Israeli history, Begin is there talking about his wife and saying how she was literally this rock who got him through his 30 years in the political wilderness. And it's just so hard to imagine anybody nowadays. I mean, can you imagine Bibi leaving this weekend and saying, oh, there's one person I really have to thank? Well, he might say it about Yair, I guess, but maybe not his wife.
For a lot of Israelis, Begin is synonymous with the Likud. Does this movie manage to capture the drama of Begin's historic 1977 election win, the upheaval, the Mapach, that it refers to in the title?
Funnily enough, it doesn't so much. And the documentary almost starts in 77 when it kind of talks about him in the 40s and with the Irgun, and then we fast forward to 1977 and, you know, election night in May 77, and then it kind of looks into him as prime minister. So we don't get all of those interesting years in the wilderness when he was, you know, he was a remarkable figure, because who else could you imagine sort of being in opposition for 29 years and finally coming good and changing Israeli society so much? So it is, I mean, they're right, it is an incredible journey, but it's more...
And from what I understand, it doesn't linger too long on that old chestnut of one person's freedom fighter being another person's terrorist?
It doesn't really, no. That's kind of glossed over. I mean, a lot of things about him are glossed over. They do talk about the First Lebanon War, but... Yeah, with the Irgun and his rival with Ben-Gurion. We could have got more of that. But yeah, they talk about the King David Hotel bombing, but you don't watch it for revelations about that.
Right.
I think there is definitely a room for a definitive Menachem Begin documentary, but I think that would actually have to come from Israel rather than America.
Interesting. Well, I was kind of hoping there would be some dramatizations in the movie. I can picture Martin Scorsese or Joe Pesci playing Menachem Begin. For our listeners who won't
be funny.
For any of our listeners who won't be spending the next few weeks watching the European Championship, Adrian, that's football for anybody who doesn't know, do I even need to point out that Israel failed to qualify? No, I don't. Got a binge recommendation for us?
Well, I actually really like the Israeli show Black Space, which is, I mean, I think you have to have a certain chutzpah or a certain Israeliness to decide that a high school shooting is an appropriate setting for a thriller, and I think that's probably why there hasn't been an American show like this before. But it's a very interesting use of like two things that Israel does well: shows for kids and thrillers, and it kind of merges them to really sort of quite powerful effect. And that it kind of just, it was on Israeli TV earlier this year, and now it's on Netflix. And it's been in the top 10 in Netflix for the last few weeks.
Impressive.
It's interesting.
All right. Not a kid show, though.
Well, parts of it are. That's the strange thing. I mean, they definitely don't give you the full-blooded violence that actually... Yeah, this isn't a Gus Van Sant version of a high school shooting. This is very much a sanitized version, but... I mean, I could imagine my kids watching it.
And it's in Hebrew with English subtitles for listeners overseas. Mm-hmm. So, speaking of movies and archaeology, nice segue coming up here, is everyone excited by the news that Harrison Ford was spotted last week on the set of the latest Indiana Jones movie? Are we fans?
We are fans.
Yeah, apparently the movie's being shot in the northeast of England, which is my neck of the woods, and Ford even paid a visit to my hometown and was spotted cycling along the banks of the River Tyne. So that'll be something to look forward to. Guys, I'm afraid we're out of time. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Judy Maltz, Ruthie Schuster, Ariel David, and Adrian Hennigan.
Thank you.
Thank you, listener, for joining us. And thanks, as always, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again on Monday with what could be the first episode of Haaretz Weekly in the post-Netanyahu era. Until then, Shabbat Shalom from Tel Aviv.